Good morning. Good to see that you all made it here through ice and cold. So I've decided that the next couple talks that I give are going to be about different ones of the paramitas. And today, my talk is called The Liberative, as in liberation, power of the third paramita of Kshanti, or tolerance, or patience. So it's the paramitas are the practices of a bodhisattva. And here at Zen Center, we... In our Mahayana tradition, we recite the Bodhisattva vows every week, and we contemplate the implications of those and of living them in our lives, in our actual lives, at this current place and time. So we have an aspiration, and we might have a growing sense of what that means in our lives. To manifest these individually and collectively together. We may grapple within ourselves and maybe with a teacher or a guide with how we're doing with the project of waking up from delusion, grasping, and from ill will or hatred. So I was reading somewhere recently about some research into how hatred and intolerance is propagated in us in groups. And one of the things said that struck me was that, and maybe this would seem like a no-brainer to you, is that our leaders in public office, in public or private organizations are really important to us as human beings in terms of holding a space for tolerance and for kindness and diversity, and that we as groups of human beings are vulnerable to tribalism, we're vulnerable to groupthink, and so we need our leaders to address that, so that we can remain grounded in human values like truth and tolerance, kindness that's not exclusionary. So although it seems like a no-brainer, all we have to do is look around at what's happening in the world today with the outbreaks of violence and hate speech. And we can see that perhaps it needs to be emphasized a little bit more. So maybe we never thought that this would be a problem in our time. But even that assumption is based on basically a place of privilege, of having been privileged. As white people, we have not experienced as much hate and prejudice as people of color have for hundreds of years in this country. So our very survival hasn't depended on practicing a great deal of forbearance. So even though there's research out about this, it may not be enough for some people who don't acknowledge scientific research. However, I think it's something worth pursuing is policies that are supported by research. Like, how can we develop a kinder and more peaceful and just society, so that people aren't as vulnerable to hatred and violent acts. So our spiritual practices should offer us some support in replacing our vulnerability to the darker aspects of our nature with the lighter, more compassionate, kind part of our nature. So these parameters or perfections are guides and they're practices, and they're part of the Mahayana teachings on ethics and the cultivation of character. So paramita is a kind of a technical term, naming those dimensions of human character that are most essential to the project of waking up to enlightenment. But the trouble with the English translation of paramita as perfection is that it implies that there's some place we're going to get to, some endpoint, where we no longer have to practice these, and we're done, and we've reached complete, perfect enlightenment, where there won't be any more striving and self-cultivation, and where no further enlightenment will be possible or desired. So in this view, enlightenment is like the prize. It's like the prize for the race, the human race. Remember once hearing that the actress Jamie Lee Curtis said that when her son found out that we were called the human race, he was very distressed by that. He thought, race? I don't want to be in a race. It didn't appeal to him at all. So she wrote a book addressing that. I don't know the name of that book, children's book, but you could look it up. So this is sort of a common way for some of us to look at practice at the beginning, that we're going to work at it. We're going to do the practice and it's going to result in awakening or something very good, we hope. Maybe we even hope that after that we won't have to put out so much effort. But as we stay with it and we learn more, we find out that it's a point of it's an important point of Buddhist wisdom, and perhaps especially in Zen, that makes a target of this assumption. It says basically, that's not true. This practice is endless, and there's never an end to awakening. And that the Bodhisattva vow, in fact, is a vow to go on practicing these paramitas for life after life, to come back. As long as there are people, human beings and other beings who are suffering, we'll come back and address that. So we're not going to get out of that one, according to Buddhism, according to Mahayana. And that even awakening is subject to impermanence, constant change. And that's, and that no matter how much we realize, there's still more to realize. It's endless. It's endless. So that's freedom from fixed beliefs. And to the extent we find that frustrating, we can gain insight into the degree that we've bought into that idea of some destination for our path, and we can let go of it. That's the opportunity. So it's an important point, because in the Heart Sutra, this term complete perfect enlightenment is used, and we seem to have a hook in our minds for phrases like that one. At least I do. I don't know about you. Anyway, it's easy to get hung up on those phrases that are in the tradition, and especially at the beginning of practice. So we also have in the Bodhisattva vows these seemingly grandiose statements about freeing all beings everywhere, in every place and time. And as bodhisattvas in training. And some people, when they come here at first or to other Zen centers and they recite these vows, they're uncomfortable with the idea of reciting those vows. And that's okay. You don't need to recite them. You don't need to hold your hands in gassho. If you want to, we invite you to. But it's not something that... There are no beliefs that we expect you to adopt. Or even though we talk about things a lot, we talk about the teachings a lot, there is no requirement to step out of where you're comfortable when you come here. So contemplating this dynamism or tension between these statements about complete perfect enlightenment and our bodhisattva vows to free all beings with the teachings of constant change, impermanence, that reality is always flowing, and that we inter-are with each other and all beings, and there's no beginning, and there's no end. We learn to apprehend and live into a middle way between those extremes, between aspiration and vow, and the actual reality that's beneath our feet. So my Dharma brother, Shokan Wyckoff, has a teaching about that, about how enlightenment is right beneath your feet. And it's not far from right here, right now. And so our invitation is to discover that and what that means for us. So, there's no destination, particular destination, except for that, this thought of awakening, this idea that, yes, I can do this. I can, perhaps this could happen to me, this accident of awakening, and I'm going to do these practices and follow this path with the help of Sangha and Dharma and teachers and all beings. And that since our goal is awakening, that we're going to want to cultivate character along the way, using the paramitas and the precepts. And that we'll see ourselves as both free to do these practices and responsible to do them. And that we'll develop the resolve. And that if we don't feel that way, we really feel like, oh, I can't do this. This is way too much. I actually felt that way when I used to listen to Katagiri talk about the bodhisattva path. I'd think, oh, I'll never be able to do this. Never. But thankfully, hanging around people who are confident of that is helpful. So gradually, I developed the resolve and the confidence that I could, in fact, practice that. So the six paramitas, by the way, are generosity and morality or ethics, tolerance or patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. And they are part of a system of training rather than a set of principles or rules. So they're training aids which are very alive and impactful. Taken together, they're an ethical program that train us, or those of us who want to do it, in these basic dimensions of human life in deeper ways. So they're like the precepts, also like the precepts, the way that we teach them and offer them here is that they are not prescriptive. They're not like to-do lists or commandments. So more important than the application of rules is the aliveness of practicing with these. And it's also the human beings, more important than these, are the human beings that embody these qualities. So I'm thinking about people that have really particularly embodied these qualities for me, such as Thich Nhat Hanh and Dalai Lama, non-Buddhists like Gandhi, and to some extent MLK, and even the women who started Black Lives Matter, Bernie Glassman. Recently, Bernie Glassman and Thich Nhat Hanh have transitioned to other modes of being. Bernie has died. He's passed away recently. And Thich Nhat Hanh has moved back to Vietnam to live out the rest of his life in his home country, which he was barred from for most of his life, adult life. And I want to talk a little bit about both Thich Nhat Hanh and Bernie Glassman, because both of them really pioneered ways of bringing this practice of awakening off the cushion and into society, into day-to-day life. Bernie with his opening a bakery in a low-income neighborhood and offering jobs to people there, his Bearing Witness retreats, his street retreats. We had Laura Kennedy here one day to give a talk where she talked about being on a street retreat, how powerful that was for her, to get in touch with what it's like to live with no cushion, you know, just completely vulnerable. And his retreats at Auschwitz, and his bearing witness has been really a major practice for me in my work as a chaplain. And I think the psychologists are catching on now to that, realizing that it's not about fixing people so much, treatment plans, as it is about accompanying people, walking with them, being present to people when they're suffering without trying to do something with it, take it away, but just to be there. And that is the healing. So he's been very influential for me, his work anyway. I've never actually met him. And Thich Nhat Hanh's work with his anti-war activities, you know, and his innovative, creative ways of looking, of translating the early Buddhist teachings into modern life for people, mass numbers of people, Pema Chodron. What a pioneer in her work, you know, with exchanging self and other, with Tonglen, and starting where you are, dealing with life when life falls apart. So those are some people that have really manifested the Paramitas for me. And that's important. That's important. So the first Paramita and the most common starting place is the practice of generosity, followed by morality and ethics, but it's not a stepladder, step-by-step kind of a practice. They inter-are, just as the Eightfold Path also. It's more like a hologram. They all work together. But for the purposes of study, we can take one out and focus on it, and I'm focusing on tolerance or forbearance today. I think recent events in my life of feeling my age more and having some personal minor injury of my own and the pain that went with that, and then also my husband's accident and injury, that has really brought up this teaching for me of tolerance, forbearance, and retreats. Sitting practice is our primary practice of tolerance and forbearance here. We had a retreat yesterday. We had a session half day, and we had a wonderful group, lots of brand new people. And, you know, we talked in Doksan about, you know, just, you know, how challenging it is to sit still with whatever comes up, physically, mentally, emotionally, and that is a primary practice of tolerance and forbearance, learning how to be with what we are, how we're manifesting now, this moment. How's my body this moment? How's my mind this moment? So these, all these practices, all these Eightfold Path and Paramitas work together dynamically, and they're alive. They're alive. They're not just words on a piece of paper. Call my words here. So in Zen, we stress most meditation, meditation, meditation. You hear about that a lot here. And that's super important. But we also do well to think about what the Tibetan Buddhists sometimes call the preliminary practices, which in the way that they teach are important prerequisites for doing a lot of meditation. So for them, it's important to cultivate ethics, morality, and generosity before sitting down and doing long sits. Because it helps to calm the mind down. But in Zen, we just come and we just sit down. And then we hear about this later. You just sit down and be quiet and sit with what comes up, and then we bring that in one-to-one meetings. We bring what comes up and receive guidance that way. When we receive our inner guidance. So this patience, forbearance, it's been considered a central virtue in Buddhism throughout the history. It's one of the 10 perfections of the Buddha that are praised in the Pali Sutras. And it continued to develop throughout Mahayana Buddhism. Shantideva, the famous scholar monk from the 8th century that some of you know of, some of you've studied his, let's see, what's the name of his book? It's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He went so far as to claim that there's no spiritual practice equal to tolerance. So I'm going to talk about now four aspects of practicing with and the theory of in Buddhism around kshanti, or the perfection of endurance. So one is the perfection of composure, to be calm and focused in the midst of adversity, well composed. Katagiri called this imperturbability. Imperturbability. I don't know how he said that word with the L's in it and everything. He had trouble with L's. He put a high value on this aspect of tolerance. His name, Dainin, means great patience. And in his books, he talks about how hard patience was for him as a younger monk living with his teacher, who was very plain, very calm, very steady. And Katagiri didn't appreciate that so much until later, until he was older. He was often impatient with how simple and ordinary the practice was with his teacher, and he struggled with the fact that nothing seemed to be happening. And he wanted to leave. So maybe that's why he was so patient with with me as a young practitioner, because in my early practice days, I had a similar issue. I had a hard time with sesshins. I wanted to leave. I was antsy and bored and pent up, and I wanted to get out of there. And his response to that was acceptance and imperturbability with my perturbed self. Oops. Wow. Gotta watch my hands flying around. And steadiness. But no sweet candy or no concessions. Just patience. In each moment, as the universe, he tells a story about this calm in the face of imperturbability, in the face of crisis. He tells about an earthquake that hit a Heiji monastery where he lived for 2 years and trained, and how different monks and abbots reacted to that. He said there was one really old abbot who was just very calm and very slow. There was another person, another teacher, who had very good deportment under other circumstances, but who ran away and kind of freaked out during this situation. And he really, I really impressed him, and he never forgot it. Thich Nhat Hanh tells the famous story about the boat people and how just one person in the boats, when the pirates would take the boats over, who kept calm, could help everyone to not freak out and to handle the situation and to reduce the harm of the situation. And I hadn't thought about this until recently, but when I was a child and a tornado came and tore through our house and blew it away, my mother was that calm one person for her four girls. And I mean, later you knew that she'd experienced trauma and that it had its effects, but at the time, she was that calm person. Mr. Rogers tells us to look for the helpers, those people who are basically bodhisattvas in these situations. And that's an important aspect of tolerance and forbearance as we see more natural disasters unfolding. Fires, right? So two, hatred and anger as poisons to overcome in ourselves, and seeing those who would direct harm to us as our teachers. So, the classical Buddhist texts direct bodhisattvas in training to regard those who would direct ill will or harm toward us as teachers. And I think that this is pretty challenging to those of us in the West who aren't raised with anything like this concept. We may have heard about turning the other cheek in our Christian upbringing, some of us who were raised Christian. But I don't know about you, but I largely saw that as something that only really exceptional beings like Christ would even want to do, much less actually be able to do. Now, I grew up watching Westerns on TV where when the bad guys came and shot up the town, the guy with the white hat on the white horse got vengeance for everybody. So that was my idea. I watched a lot of Westerns. other forms of enculturation. And we live in a society where, you know, we have a military that goes out and shakes the big stick, and we're all about our president, so I don't have to go into that. But it's like the opposite of this that we're raised with. We're raised with the idea that vengeance and justice are normal. Are normal. And retaliation in response to threats is normal. And if we don't retaliate, we're weak, and we're going to get, with that weakness, we're going to be hammered. They're going to roll over us. So this one is extremely edgy for us. It's very countercultural, very controversial. But for me, just knowing that this is a thing in Buddhism is helpful. Just reading about it. Extremely difficult to practice and often questioned, but useful to know about and to contemplate and even try, as I've practiced over the years, to practice. Seeing someone who brings me distress, either consciously or unconsciously, as a teacher. You know, pointing out. Again, Shantideva is a provocateur about this. He provokes us to take it in. But remember, these teachings are directed at people living a monastic life, a life that's already been simplified and has this basic, the central concern of that life is awakening. But now we can take these teachings and attempt to live in the world, but not of it, with the help of these teachings. So here Shantideva goes on, the generosity and morality performed throughout thousands of eons, hatred destroys it all. There's no evil equal to hatred and no spiritual practice equal to tolerance. Therefore, one should develop tolerance by various means with great effort. Then he continues with describing how we become disfigured by hatred until the beauty of human life has disappeared. In short, he goes on, there's no sense in which someone prone to anger is well off. So, hatred in early Buddhism is considered to be the most deadly of the three poisons, with the most potential to destroy lives. And thus the ability to respond with calm and equanimity to others' attempts to harm us has been singled out in these Mahayana texts as a necessary condition for living the spiritual life of a bodhisattva. So nobody ever said it was going to be easy, right? Bodhisattvas, he goes on, do not get angry in situations where harm comes from all directions. They don't engage in blaming, reviling, striking, threatening, or harming others for the sake of retaliation. And further, they don't cling to resentment. And there's a variety of ways in the sutras that were given to cultivate the ability to practice this. So one is calming meditation, basic shamatha, or just sitting, allowing the mind to calm. And the breath. The breath is always with us, so we can use the breath when we don't have a cushion or a half an hour or an hour or a whole day to sit. So calming heals our reactivity and it brings anger. It can bring anger to a still point. Another one is insight practices. So, such as sitting with and seeing the seeds of passion and reactivity in our storehouse consciousness. You've been hearing about that more lately from Tim and from Ben. And that sometimes show themselves in our daily interactions with other people, but more safely, we can see them and practice calming those in our meditation. That's a safe place. So techniques that encourage us to transform, another one is techniques that encourage us to transform our understanding of the situation. So reflecting on the idea that those who treat us unjustly or with malice are, unbeknownst to them, serving as our teachers in this practice of the perfection of tolerance. And the shift in perspective changes the way we conceive of an event that's difficult for us. Potentially, it can. It focuses all attention on what we might learn from the situation that we find ourselves in. And here's what the Dalai Lama says about it. He says, it's very helpful to think of adversity as not so much a threat to our peace of mind, but rather as the means by which patience is attained. From this perspective, we see that those who would harm us are, in a sense, teachers of patience. Such people teach us what we could never learn merely from hearing someone give a talk, for instance. From adversity, we can, however, learn the value of patient forbearance. And in particular, those who would harm us give us the unparalleled opportunity to practice disciplined behavior. Now, this is a hard shift to make, and it may not be a beginner's practice. I think much calm abiding and development of self-compassion and loving kindness toward the self may need to be practiced before diving into this practice that the Dalai Lama talks about and Shanti Deva talk about. Or it might be something you have already practiced without realizing that it's a paramita or a Buddhist practice, classical Buddhist practice. So in a sense, those of us who realize that we've had a lot of privilege, that our lives go pretty well most of the time, and have the energy to do this deep work, because we haven't been forced to develop forbearance as a means of survival, can potentially try this. I won't speculate too much on that. Another one, reflecting on the basic Buddhist concepts of dependent co-arising and no self in order to depersonalize interpersonal relations. This is something like the detachment that the 12 steps offers us as a practice. So it's by no means a cool and uncaring attitude on our part. It's rather an increased commitment to apply the cooling effect of dispassion to the flames of conflict. So another one. From a Dharma point of view, at the basis of all human anger and aggression is this misconception of the self. Misunderstanding who and what we are, we might act as if our own personal well-being is the only thing that matters in life. So when anyone causes us harm or affront, we treat that as a major affront to justice, something for which we have to compensate for immediately. And overcoming the false and persistent sense of self is central to the whole history of Buddhist thought and practice. An emphasis is clearly on the basic concept of no self. The idea is that once we've thoroughly seen through the false idea of a separate and solid self that we need to protect at all costs, that we'll be able to tolerate much of what causes us to be angry and resentful and maybe even despairing. And realizing impermanence and no self can be unsettling, can be pretty unsettling at times. I found that in my work with hospice that I really could see I was very close with no filters to impermanence. And I did find it to be unsettling. And there was a while where I felt very vulnerable from that, you know, because I just was so close. So I think sometimes there's sort of a use for our the things that, you know, our rationalizations about how life is that keep us going from day to day. They can have their uses in the relative dimension of things. Because in the Mahayana text, they talk about that, the fact that there's a fear in people of realizing fully emptiness, no self, and impermanence. So part of developing forbearance and tolerance is developing the tolerance to look at that up close without becoming too fearful or falling into nihilism. So, shredding the rationalizations that are part of our misunderstanding. Here's what Shantideva, the provocateur, says. After arousing awakening mind out of the wish for the happiness of every being, why are you angry at them now that they've found happiness for themselves? It's hard to admit when we feel envious of another's good fortune, don't you think? Because we're spiritual people, we're not supposed to be envious of that. How good it is to air that one out. Another trip we lay on ourselves about being a spiritual person. So, another way of dealing with this basic self-centeredness is with the practice of the four immeasurable minds. Maybe it was last month, Ben had us do, some of you were probably here for that. He talked about loving kindness. He had us practice the Metta Sutra, recite it, and then he did a guided meditation with us. So all of those immeasurable minds, the practices that exist for cultivating those are really helpful for reducing, for calming and preparing for going more deeply and excavating more deeply. So we can practice replacing, you know, that mind that doesn't want to, that feels envy at another's good fortune with empathetic joy. That's an actual cultivatable state of heart-mind. So next, dependent arising, another Buddhist concept used to undermine those feelings of anger and frustration. It's used through attempting to help us understand how the person treating us badly might have been treated, how they might have come to be the way that they are, to act the way that they are. What have been the causes and conditions into that? We can reflect on that. If I can see how a person who caused me harm, committed violence toward me in any way, was harmed, maybe I can soften my reactions. There's a doctor of psychology from Vancouver, Canada. I think his name is pronounced Gabor Mate. I'm not sure. Do you know Bill? Gabor. Yeah, and he writes about how addiction and violence are both, they both come out of trauma that's unhealed. And it helps somehow to educate ourselves about where harm originates, where it comes from. Maybe we could, as a society, use these new insights and understandings into what causes violence, what causes addiction, to try to ameliorate those conditions. I hope so. Meanwhile, we've got some practices to help us to develop the capacity to transform those things in ourselves into bodhisattva powers. The 10 powers, there's a chant. It's, do you remember that, Myo-on? The chant about the meal chant about completing the 10 powers. I always thought, what are those 10 powers? And there was never any explanation around of what they were. So then I found out later, years later, that they don't refer to the ability to fight off hordes of zombies or fly across the city or dematerialize like a Marvel comic. Have any of you seen Black Panther? That was fun. There was a lot of those kinds of powers displayed there. These powers are the miraculous powers, the powers of a bodhisattva, are the miraculous powers of humility, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, forbearance, morality, generosity, etc. Those are the miraculous powers of a bodhisattva. So I will leave you today with this invitation to practice these along with me. If you want to come talk with me about them anytime, I would enjoy that. And what I tend to talk about in my talks often, not always, but often, are things that I'm working with, that I'm practicing with. And I share them with you in hopes that they're helpful to you too. And I really wanted to end this with a poem by Kaz Ta-Nehisi, but I couldn't find it. So I'm sorry. No poems today, but I hope that we'll have a few minutes to discuss some of the implications maybe of practicing the traditional idea of patience or forbearance, non-retaliation. And remember, Martin Luther King required non-retaliation and the ability to practice forbearance of his followers in his movement. Gandhi as well also required the ability to forbear physical and mental harm. Bodhisattva practice. So when is it being servile and passive, and when is it an actual power? Okay, thanks for listening. Anybody want to respond to those questions or say anything else that may have come up for you?
So, I admit I like to watch Saturday Night Live. Yesterday, during the day, came to my attention, I didn't watch the week before, but somebody on Saturday Night Live made fun of this person who was running, I'm not sure if it's a state senate or national senate, and he is a veteran and had an eye patch on his eye, and he was being made fun of by somebody on Saturday Night Live in a very inappropriate way. And yesterday I saw some article online or a little interview online with this person, and he and somebody was, the interviewer was trying to egg him on, and he said, "What was said was offensive, but I'm not offended."
So pretty good.
And then last night I was watching Saturday Night Live, and it's during this news segment, and this fellow came on the show, and the person who offended him was sitting there right next to him, and he apologized, and this man took it all in good stride, and he accepted the apology, and then he was making fun of the original person. You know, it was very scripted, I guess, and, you know, to make fun, but it was like the two of them came together, and the person who was, and I guess he won his election, and he's a Republican. Oh, but You know, it didn't matter at that moment. This person just was so keen on not escalating this whole thing and being accepting of somebody's forgiveness and originally not being offended, but knowing that what was said was offensive. And I think this speaks quite well to this forbearance and patience.
How come so many good things come from comedy shows now? You know? So enlightened perspectives come from comedy shows. Thanks, Susan. Anyone else? There was someone.
Well, I was going to ask you to elaborate more on the difference between tolerance and passivity, but I think that story actually told us a lot about the difference.
Yeah, yeah. That guy, the one who was with the patch, who had been in the military, right?
Yes.
Was anything but passive in his tolerance, right? Yeah. Cool.
So really start from what you were saying, Susan, my work on violence against women issues. And I had an experience really within the last year where we observed a person who is working with men's groups who have been men who have been convicted of violence, and they've been ordered by the court to go to go to these groups and stay in them for months and trying to change into people who are not violent. And it was a complete understanding for me the first time I saw one of those groups, because it was clear how these men, they were all men, were suffering. And the facilitators of the group were able to see that in the way that they worked with the group. And I think it was because they came to it, and they had this years of experience of with acceptance and forbearance or tolerance, but understanding that these men were also very much, I don't want to say victims, but of the identification of their own selves and masculinity and power.
Mm-hmm. And violence that comes out of that power, yeah.
I just felt such compassion for something that I had never
And you know that before you observe, perhaps you could see more the sort of barriers you put up or boundaries between that. That's not me, right? That's not me. That's bad and evil, and then something like you experience takes away some of that certainty in that. Yeah. Thank you. Did you hear what she was talking about? Working with a program with women who are in relationships with violent men, and that she watched a group for the men, a long-term group, and saw, was able to see them as perhaps victims themselves of causes and conditions that created that in them, and see those boundaries that she put up between, you know, self and other kind of soften. Anybody else? It's a long time, I know. We have one more minute if you want to discuss. Yes.
I come from a family, immediate and extended, that is very strong on their end of the political spectrum, and have since come to a place myself where I'm much more moderate, which means that now I put myself in places where I hear from the other end of the political spectrum. And it stands out to me that both ends of the spectrum have parts of the solution. You know, one end will have the solution for problem A, the other end has the solution for problem B. And each one sees that the other side is not solving the other solution. And so they, you know, in this hurt of feeling like, oh no, that solution is not being met, now I feel hurt, now I feel angry because you seem to think you have all of the solutions, and so now I'm going to throw my solution at your face. But rather than giving it as like a remedy for an illness, we like, you know, those old urban legends of like how on Halloween, you know, supposedly people were putting razor blades into apples. That's totally why we get each other from the opposite sides of the political spectrum. Here is this nourishing apple with all of my harmful anger inside of it, and you don't get one or the other. You have to swallow both, or I am not going to be satisfied. And so the importance of tolerance in terms of being able to see that their anger comes from hurt, and to hold space for them, to also like hold space for yourself in terms of not taking in their anger, which harms us, and being able to offer your solution without throwing in, like without needing to punish them for what they couldn't see, is the irony. Here's the really potent irony: is that the people who care the most are the ones who hurt the deepest, are the ones who have the greatest anger, are the ones who put the sharpest razors into the apples that they share. The ability to like create that space where we watch our own reactions and to recognize that we didn't go straight to anger, but that there was a sense of pain first, to learn to sit with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the vulnerability to let the other side see your pain and not your anger. That's what opens hearts.
That's the real radical act there, isn't it? Of vulnerability and willingness to be vulnerable. And sometimes it doesn't always feel safe to be vulnerable, you know. So it has to be really case by case. But truly, unless we're willing, especially in our interpersonal relationships, we're not able to get past the conflicts that come up, you know. And then the pile of grievances just grows. So, yeah. Thank you.